ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For the first time in over 50 years, astronauts will soon fly around the moon.
They're ready to fly.
But there are real concerns about their safety.
We're playing Russian roulette.
In our series, The Challenger Legacy, we trace the history of two space shuttle disasters. And we ask, what are the lessons for today?
I'm Karl Kuschelnitsky.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Binge all the episodes now. Just search for The Challenger Legacy on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Suddenly, we're in the middle of a petrol crisis.
In Australia currently, we hold 1.5 billion litres of petrol and 3 billion litres of diesel in our minimum stock obligation, which is in effect a strategic reserve.
But how long will that last? Maybe a month, unless there's panic buying. It wasn't long ago, in the year 2000, that Australia made most of the petrol it used, and it made most of it, as much as 90%, from Australian oil. These days, we import most of our petrol and diesel, and what we do make, we make from imported oil. What happened? And what's likely to happen if supply from the Middle East stops? To get a handle on what a retail price of $2.20 per litre or more is likely to mean, and there's talk of $2.50 per litre, it helps to understand how the market for petrol works. It's peculiar. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin. And my guest this week, someone paid to understand where petrol comes from, it's part of his job, Sol Kavanagh, the senior energy analyst at MST Financial, and Angela McDonald-Smith, who's senior resources writer at the Australian Financial Review. Welcome, Angela, and welcome, Sol.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
Likewise.
Angela, a lot of us probably don't think too much about where our petrol comes from. If we remember anything, we might remember those TV ads in the 1980s. Mike Willacy used to stroll around oil rigs in Bass Strait, reassuring us they were good for the marine life.
Believe it or not, these seals share the same small island as 40 men. The island is an SOBHP oil platform, and like the others in Bass Strait, it has become a home for all kinds of marine life.
Bass Strait alone produced 70% of all the oil we refined. We had 8 oil refineries producing petrol and diesel and jet fuel and bitumen and a lot more besides. Then, mainly during the 2000s, all but 2 closed. What happened, Angela?
Yes, it's certainly a different picture these days. I think when I started writing about the Australian energy sector back in 2000, there were indeed 8 refineries here spread across Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia. But they were all pretty old and inefficient in comparison with some of the huge new oil refineries being built across Asia. And most of them were closed down just one by one. That's increased our reliance, of course, on imported petrol and diesel gradually. And I think at the moment, about 85 to 90% of our road transport fuels are imported.
We still do export crude oil, though, mainly from the Northwest Shelf. So we export while importing. Why don't we use that ourselves?
Yeah, sounds like a bit of a bad joke, but most of the crude oil we produce here in Australia is sort of the wrong kind of oil in a way. It's this light crude or condensates, and it's just not great for producing the mix of petrol and diesel that we use locally here. The refineries just weren't built to process that type of crude.
What's the broader story about the decline of Australia's refining industry, Sol? Why has Australian refinery after Australian refinery closed?
Well, starting point is Australia's refineries, including the 2 that remain, are relatively small, old, and therefore higher unit cost refineries compared to, you know, the big super refineries you see being built in Asia and in the Middle East.
Does scale really matter? Is size really important?
Well, refining is a margin business, so it's all about that unit cost, and that's where scale really matters, but also your industrial hubs and your input costs, where Australia is also not very competitive with Asia. makes it the margins just that little bit worse than all the other ones. And so then the economics in normal times of a refinery where you can barely eke out any margin made it quite difficult. And so you started to see the companies involved make a commercial decision to no longer invest in the refineries to keep them going here and instead move their refining capacity elsewhere. Now, that obviously makes sense from a commercial perspective from the companies, but from an Australian perspective, it puts us in a much more precarious state in terms of the security of our fuel supply chains.
Angela, we have Viva, that's one of the refining companies. It's better known here as Shell or OTR because that's where they sell their petrol. That's at Geelong. We have the Ampol refinery near Brisbane. They're paid 1.8 cents per litre by the government at the moment to make fuel, and other guarantees are in place as well. Does it look as if they could survive without government handouts, or are we in a situation, I suppose, maybe like the car industry, where they, in order to survive, if we want them to survive, we need to keep supporting them financially?
Yeah, well, under that 2021 deal, really the future of those two plants is only assured for another year or so. It was, I think, till June 30, 2027 that both the Lytton Refinery in Brisbane and Geelong Refinery is supported. And also, I think you've got to remember about that deal. It sounds like a great deal, but at the same time, it only kicks in when refining margins are particularly low. And the deal's actually under renegotiation at the moment. We're supposed to hear something about it this month, in fact. And you can imagine that, you know, the current situation with this focus on fuel security with the war in Iran, there's definitely going to be some incentive on the part of government to actually ensure that both those plants keep running.
So there's two things here, Peter. So one is the focus on security of supply chains, including fuel, got a lot more focus now than it did 5 years ago or many time over the last couple of decades, just given how the geopolitical landscape has changed and the big shocks we've seen to supply chains over the last 5 years. But the second part of this is from the political angle. Right now, the Labor government is trying to prop up manufacturing across the country. And the idea that will allow the last two refineries to shut down, where they employ a large amount of union jobs, who's a major stakeholder in the Labor government, I think is also just politically unpalatable. So we will see policy tweaked, as Angela says, to keep these going. And I think there's a good national and economic security reason for it, but there's also this good political and jobs reason for it.
Jobs and politics are partly what we're about here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week discussing petrol and diesel in a time of crisis, energy specialists Sol Kavanagh and Angela McDonald-Smith. Saul, if our refined petrol and diesel and jet fuel mainly come from Singapore, with some from South Korea and Japan, the oil used to refine those products mainly comes from the Middle East through the Strait of Hormuz, which is effectively closed at the moment. What's that closure doing and what's it likely to do to the supply of fuel? And this gets updated day by day. Can you take us through what's happened since Israel attacked Iran 12 days ago?
Sure. So I think the starting point is Australia's fuel use, about 20% of it comes from crude, which will be directly impacted by what's gone in global markets, which come through our refineries. We import the crude. So we have the refineries, but we're still reliant on external crude because, as you say, we don't produce much anymore. And then the remaining 80% is direct product imports, which come from refineries in Asia. And most of those refineries, the largest part of the crude that they use to go and make those products that we import comes from the Middle East. So 20% of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz coming from the Middle East. Right now, the Strait of Hormuz is basically almost shut. And that's causing the biggest supply shock to oil markets that we've seen and the record since oil markets have really began. The last time we saw major oil shocks was in the wake of the Arab oil embargo and the Iranian Revolution in the 1970s. If you look at the scale of removing 20% of the world's oil supply, that is three times the impact what we saw in the 1970s. If this disruption is sustained And I don't think it's likely that it'll be sustained for long. But if it is sustained for long, we're looking at the biggest energy crisis that has really been seen in generations, which will lead to a global economic slowdown. And indeed, part of what appears to be Iran's strategy here is to cause that global economic crisis, to put pressure on the US and its allies to de-escalate.
It's not just that the oil can't get out. Is it that Iraq and Kuwait, which have to get their oil out through the strait, can now no longer make it?
That's right. So with their ability to export removed, you're still producing the oil and then you fill up all your tanks. You can't get any more onto ships because the shipping is closed. So close to 7 million barrels a day is now shut in. And the problem with that is even, for example, if the war was to end tomorrow, it's now going to take weeks to restart a lot of that production and get your supply chains working again. And that's before we talk about the gas side of this, which is impacted even more rapidly and to a more severe extent than oil.
Are there other ways to get the oil and gas out apart from through the strait?
So for oil, there's various mitigation measures in place here. So if we're starting point, as you say, 20 million barrels a day comes out of the Strait of Hormuz normally. Right now, there's about 1 to 2 million barrels we can still get out. Those are the Iranian volumes because obviously the Iranians are not attacking their own tankers. Of the other 18, Saudi and the UAE can get perhaps an additional 5 to 6 million barrels via a pipeline out through the Red Sea. And then in addition to that, we've got global strategic stocks, which might be able to release between another 3 and 7 million barrels a day. So the 20 million barrels a day outage could be reduced down to a 5 to 8 million barrel day outage. But even that, you know, even with all those mitigation measures in place, even that is still a massive supply shock to the market.
Angela, what about our reserves? We heard Chris Bowen, the energy minister, mention them earlier. How much do we hold in reserve and where is it?
Yes, Chris Bowen has been at pains to point out that our reserves of petrol, diesel and jet fuel are actually quite a bit higher than they were back in 2022, the last sort of global energy crisis of sorts when Russia invaded Ukraine. So I think we've got about diesel, you know, 30 days now of stockpiles for diesel. That compares with about 21 days back in 2021. But it's still quite a bit lower than 90 days recommended by the International Energy Agency. So I think the situation is definitely causing a bit of angst at the moment. We've seen that panic buying at petrol stations and queuing and some limits on fuel purchases and shortages in rural areas.
The government has actually paid Viva Energy to build diesel storage. There's something else we've done which seems on the face of it bizarre. We've established oil reserves in Louisiana and Texas in the United States. They hold oil for Australia. The Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, in 2020 finalised a deal to store Australian purchased crude in the US. How does that work?
Yes, that's always seemed a little bit of an odd one to me. It's a sort of leasing and storage agreement that, as you say, Angus Taylor put in place back in 2020. And that means that Australia holds government-owned crude oil within the US Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And that's a reserve which is held in underground caverns in those two states, Louisiana and Texas. And, you know, in theory, Australia can draw down on those stocks in an emergency. So those reserves sort of shift Australia's stocks, in theory, up towards that 90-day reserve target that the IEA recommends. But, of course, they are held in the US, so that's about 2 to 3 weeks away by tanker.
It is the most preposterous boondoggle of an idea that we have reserves. So the whole reason you have a strategic reserve is when you have a major geopolitical event where your maritime routes are disrupted, and you're not able to import. So if we're able to import our reserves from the US, then we don't need the reserve, right? And I want to highlight the risk around this, you know, and it's not just about, you know, some of the more volatile, I guess, positions from the Trump administration. Everyone will remember the bushfires in 2020 before COVID started. We had these apocalyptic skies over Sydney. Now, Australia was really focused on its bushfire efforts, right? And during that time, we needed access to satellites to help our bushfire fighting efforts. Now, Australia actually gets access to its satellites via direct contract with the US government. And right when we needed access to our satellites for our firefighting efforts, the US government didn't make those satellites available to us. Now, that was from an ally. In peacetime, we couldn't get critical infrastructure contracted from our overseas ally for an emergency. What are the chances that if we're in a much bigger national security emergency, relying now on oil from foreign nations which are less of an ally or not an ally at all than the United States, it puts us in an even more precarious situation. So I just use that as an example that the whole idea of security of supply chains means you need to have sovereign control over them, which means it needs to be within the Australian government's jurisdiction and it cannot be contracted out, even to the best allies in the world, because when push comes to shove, security of supply chains means we don't have to rely on our allies.
There was a government report, it wasn't released until 4 years later, on freedom of information, but a government report which, among other things, examined what would happen if the Strait of Hormuz was closed. And it found that we could probably last for 6 months, but we'd need to pay a higher price for petrol. Is that how it looks to you, Saul? And will this decision by members of the International Energy Agency to start releasing their stocks, which of course they can only do once, but will that decision help?
So on the stocks, it does help. Now, there's about 1.2 billion barrels of global IEA stocks. China has another billion barrels plus. So it can last actually several months. It's not just a matter of weeks, you know, assuming a kind of 3 to 5 million barrel a day rate. But where the challenge comes for Australia is we're dependent on fuel products coming from nations which are largely import dependent themselves. So a lot of this is all premised on the idea that free trade remains whole. But I want you to imagine if you are South Korea or Singapore or Malaysia, where you have a refinery and you're importing crude, and then you have a contract to export the product to Australia, but now there's a shortage and your own people are short on fuel. Now, in that scenario, are you going to prioritize your own people's fuel, even if it means breaking your contract to sell to Australia? And the politics of that suggests yes. And because Australia's at the end of that chain, we end up being left short. And it might not even be a price. It gets to the point where this becomes so acute that it doesn't matter what you pay, because ultimately other countries are subsidising effectively their own domestic consumption at the expense of their export trade partners' contracts.
Down the track then, could we see rationing? We have seen it before. Mind you, it was in the Second World War.
Well, rationing has started. There was a report that Thailand has started to implement measures, including requesting government employees work from home to reduce fuel usage. So rationing starts via demand destruction, where high prices force out, particularly in emerging economies, their ability to pay and therefore they go without. So that's what happens first. We need to see the disruption the Strait of Hormuz remain at a large scale for a prolonged period of time before that comes to Australia in a meaningful way. I think the question is, if things end up persisting for a few months here as opposed to a few weeks, does Australia want to start implementing at least some kind of voluntary demand reduction measures in addition to price in order to prepare ourselves better? It's still premature to say we need to get there yet, but that's a risk. I think it's also worth highlighting, we're talking about net volumes here, right? But a lot of it's about how our fuel is distributed across the country. And so we're obviously seeing right now some shortages in rural areas, which is going to have implications for our food production. And there's a whole discussion around what the Strait of Hormuz means for food as well. But if we particularly look at our military context, because this is, you know, we're talking about here geopolitical risk, we've only got so much jet fuel actually near our Air Force bases. And so again, the whole idea is if this scenario in the Middle East is a real wake-up call for Australia to say we need to do more to secure our fuel supply chains for the future possible risk of maritime trade disruption in the Pacific. And there's a big discussion to be had about what the implications of that would mean, and particularly if we're going to be relying, for example, on Australian Air Force to maintain free flow of trade in maritime regions in order to be able to get the fuel we need. That is meaningless if we don't have the jet fuel to keep our aircraft going, of our Air Force. And right now, that still remains a very acute risk for Australia.
Is the government on to this, Angela?
Yes, we're aware of talks that were already taking place late last year between the federal government, Defence Department, and commodity traders such as Glencore, for example, who've got worldwide networks of fuel sourcing capabilities. One can only imagine that those talks have taken on a fresh urgency at the moment, and I do believe there are more talks planned. That's actually specifically, as I understand it, with a focus on sourcing jet fuel for defence applications. Obviously so important, as Saul said.
So as we would want, the military's need for jet fuel is being prioritised rather than foreign tourists, and foreign tourism itself is about to become more expensive and less easy. We're about to turn our attention to those implications here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, our guest this week, Senior Energy Analyst at MST Financial, Saul Kavanagh, and energy writer Angela McDonald-Smith from the Australian Financial Review. Angela, the fuel shopping app PetrolSpy is now the number one downloaded app on both the Google and Apple stores in Australia, which means we're getting anxious. How high a price do you think we can endure, that the government will allow us to endure? Last time prices got this high, after Russia invaded Ukraine, the Australian government halved the fuel excise for 6 months. It cut 22 cents per litre off the price. Mind you, it was facing an election. It obviously made a judgment that something close to what the price is now was something we couldn't bear. What's your assessment of what the government's likely to do and how much pain we can bear?
Yeah, I think if you asked the refiners and suppliers like Ampol and Viva on that question a few years ago as to where that sort of pain point is, they used to signal that $2 a litre was a bit of a threshold where they saw, after which they saw some demand erosion. I'm not sure that would still be the case now. We've already got prices at $2.20 and as high as $2.40 or so in locations like Broome, more remote towns. People are starting to look for alternative transport, take the train, fewer long road trips, etc. You'd have to think also that maybe the uptake of electric cars would accelerate because, of the price volatility and uncertainty that we're seeing. Certainly since this war kicked off, several people I've spoken to have been saying they wish they'd moved earlier to buy an EV. But as to what the government would do, I don't think there's any, as you said, we're in a bit of a different sort of stage of the electoral and budget cycle at the moment. So there doesn't seem to be any move towards subsidies to the extent that we saw after the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Now, this government has just won an election rather than being about to head to an election that it was going to lose.
Yeah.
What do you see, Saul?
Look, I know there's a big focus on fuel prices, particularly now at the Bowser, but I think the bigger concern is the wider cost of living ramifications. So oil and gas flow through to the cost of almost every good and service that we have. So I'll give you an example, Peter. If you've had a chicken burger for lunch today, that chicken patty, it's about the cup of diesel required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger. And if you've had a beef burger, it's 2 cups of diesel.
That is so unappetizing.
Oh, no. But, it gives an indication of we're still fundamentally a fossil fuel-run economy. And so when you're seeing both a tightening pinch point of oil and gas at the same time, this is going to create a cost of living pressure on top of an inflation environment which is higher than the government's targeting.
I suppose there's nothing which isn't moved by fuel in Australia. Even petrol itself is moved by diesel trucks. Angela, if all of this stops now, suppliers from the Middle East reopen, those refineries in Iraq and Kuwait begin producing, is this likely to have lasting effects, perhaps lasting effects on our use of petrol and diesel and other things? Or will it just be seen as a blip?
I think it actually will have a lasting effect, just in terms of the anxiety around security of supply. You could imagine, for example, as I was saying earlier, an accelerated take up of electric vehicles, for example. You could see perhaps more momentum into biofuels, biodiesel, etc. So, plant and, animal waste type fuels, based fuels. Cost has always been an issue, of course, And we would really need some pretty strong government mandates to actually force the uptake of those fuels. But, you know, this situation of the Strait of Hormuz really does sort of pinpoint the mind on those sorts of things. So I would expect some moves from government around that, and perhaps some more moves around just, you know, local supplies of petrol and diesel, rather than, for example, that reliance in the caverns of the US.
So what lasting effects do you see? Of course, it depends on how long it lasts.
Well, we tend to have very short memories once disruptions like this do pass. My hope, however, is that this is seen as a wake-up call for us Australia and a nation. And it's worth pointing out, this is not a partisan political issue. I think this is something that's going to have bipartisan support. I think, you know, the message we've had from the Australian government over the last week has been largely constructive. But the real question I think Australia needs to ask itself in the wake of this is, are we prepared for another shock like this, particularly if it happens closer to home here in the Pacific? And do we want to be so reliant on external sources of supply for our energy and hence national and economic security as well? Or does Australia need to look to say we should actually be developing and producing more of our own oil so that we can be more self-sufficient and self-reliant in a conflict? And I know there's obviously environmental considerations at play there, but we should also keep in mind that ultimately, if that oil is going to be produced because it's going to be used, maybe we should be producing more of it ourselves rather than relying on foreign powers and sometimes hostile powers for that critical energy security that we need.
So I heard Mike Willis say there's little danger to wildlife or anything like that from fuel production, so I don't think we should be too concerned about that, or at least I didn't when I saw those ads in the 1980s. But these are important questions. Before we go, as is traditional on this program, Sol and Angela, is there anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Angela.
Well, we've been focusing in this conversation around petrol and diesel, but of course that's, you know, there's the broader upward pressure too on other types of energy. We're only a few days away from getting the first look at what energy regulators in the eastern states are proposing for electricity prices from July 1 for the next financial year. We've obviously seen some pretty strong increases in recent years, although not that much last year. I think it's been pretty much flat over the past year. But whether that's going to continue is a big focus for me. Gas prices are going to play into that. And there's also going to be all of that upward pressure from investment needed in transmission, you know, as the electricity grid moves towards renewable energy. So that's definitely something I'm going to be watching for in the next couple of weeks.
It is imminent. Saul, anything to look out for?
I think there's two important things. As Angela's saying, global gas prices are facing a bigger shock than global oil prices right now. Australia actually stands to benefit as we are a major gas exporter. And I think the key thing to watch out for is, does Australia's gas market and gas consumers remain protected from the global price shock because of our strong gas position? And my hope and expectation is, unlike in 2022, this time we will be. And the second thing, which I think is still not getting enough attention globally, is the implications for food. So around a third of the seaborne fertilizer also comes to the Strait of Hormuz.
That's more than oil.
That's right.
It's a fifth of the oil, a third of fertilizer.
It is. Also, one of the main other ways to make fertilizer is from gas, which is facing a shortage. And I think as minds coalesce around what those second and third order implications of what we've seen over the last 10 days move forward, the risk of a food crisis could actually end up outscaling the risk on the oil crisis and the gas crisis.
So, Kavanagh, energy analyst with MST Financial, and Angela McDonald-Smith, senior resources writer with the Australian Financial Review, thank you so much for your sombre assessments.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Angela.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.